Good afternoon. Thank you all for being with us this afternoon. It's so nice to see you all here for our third annual Theater Parker Church lecture. We're delighted to get this event going this afternoon, and as more people come in, we'll let them settle as they can. This lecture series welcomes speakers who address the intersection of faith and public issues, those places where our understanding of what we face as a civic community is informed and better understood through the nuance and depth of the soul's eye, we hope. There is arguably no more pressing contemporary global concern than climate change and its inherent inequities of impact. I know that I very much look forward to our speakers' assurance that there is hope in this challenge. I am so very grateful to have my colleague, the Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, join us this afternoon. A few details for all of you who may be visiting and not sure. The restrooms are across the breezeway in the Parish Hall building downstairs. We ask that you silence your phones. No need to turn them off. If you want to send messages to all your best friends and let them know what they're missing, feel free. And let them know the good news that Mariama will share with us. And we very much hope all of you will join us after our lecture this afternoon for refreshments and more conversation in the parish hall, which again is through the breezeway. You may have noticed the statue that very gently graces our front lawn. Out front, anyone see a large Theodore Parker? The ever-robust protector of our spiritual home. Before our lecture this afternoon, we want to make sure you know just a bit about who Theodore Parker was and how he informs us in today's world. So our congregation member and resident historian, Julie McVeigh, will be sharing a little bit about Theodore Parker with us. And then after Julie has a few words, the co-chair of our Social Action Committee, Allison Gottlieb, will be introducing our speaker. So welcome and thank you again for being here.
Good afternoon and welcome. Today, I would like to introduce Theodore Parker to you. We are proud of this remarkable man who began his ministry in 1837 here in West Roxbury. This church then was known as the Second Church in Roxbury. In 1962, we renamed the congregation in his honor. Parker was a prodigious biblical scholar who early linked his transcendentalist beliefs to addressing social ills of society. His voice became unique and powerful in the social justice movements of the day. In 1846, Theodore left West Roxbury for Boston. A church named the 28th Congregational Society of Boston was founded by Boston Friends, so Parker's religious and activist messages could reach a wider audience. His congregation included social reformers, abolitionists, and African Americans. As well, he traveled the Lyceum Circuit throughout the Northeast and as far west as Indiana and Ohio, giving speeches on many religious and civic issues of the day. In the middle 1800s, Boston experienced great social ferment. Parker's friends were often leading in attempts to improve social conditions, the problems of poverty, the treatment of prisoners, care for the insane, and advocating for women's rights, among many others. Parker was convinced that the abolition of slavery was essential, both for the rightness of it and to protect freedom and democracy in America. He spoke with clear, eloquent, and religious language, making the most revolutionary ideas seem reasonable. His messages were deemed radical in his day by some, and they still ring true today. About workers' rights, he said, "No man gets rich by his own work." I cannot help thinking that labor is often wickedly underpaid and capital is grossly overfed. I shall believe that capital is at the mercy of labor when the two extremes of society change places. About women's rights, he said, "Not allowing women equal access to education and commerce robs the country of half the resources available to it." As the leader of the Vigilance Committee in Boston, which was formed after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850 to protect from slave catchers, escaped slaves and wrongly arrested free blacks in Boston, Parker said, "I will do all in my power to rescue any fugitive slave from the hands of any officer who attempts to return him to bondage with such strength as I can command." Later, he said, "The fugitive has the same natural right to defend himself against the slave catcher that he has against a murderer or a wolf." More contemporaneously, Martin Luther King was paraphrasing Theodore when he talked about the arc of justice. This is what Parker said: "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. From what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice." Abraham Lincoln did not know Parker, but William Herndon, Lincoln's friend in Illinois, was a Parkerite. Likely, Lincoln read a printed sermon of Theodore's when he saw the phrase, "Democracy is government of the people, by the people, and for the people." We, members of this congregation, named for him, are glad weekly for his image here. It reminds us of our role in supporting prophetic voices of our own times and the imperative for us to continue his legacy of activism and love.
So I am honored to introduce this year's Theodore Parker Lecture speaker, Reverend Mariama White Hammond. Mariama has impressive lifelong experience with social justice and activism. For over 10 years, she was executive director of Project Hip Hop, a youth-led organization that engages young people in critical thinking, artistic production, and community organizing. Currently, Reverend Mariama, ordained in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, serves on the ministerial staff at Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain, and is a Master's of Divinity candidate at Boston University School of Theology. She serves as an ecological justice minister at Bethel AME and as a member of the leadership team of Massachusetts Interfaith Coalition for Climate Action. Her goal is to challenge the Christian church to embrace more radical understanding of the life and mission of Jesus Christ, She believes that the church must be responsive to social, economic, and climate justice issues. I first met Mariama years ago as part of a collaborative project between Project Hip Hop and Dorchester People for Peace, and was immediately impressed with her energy, vision, and commitment. More recently, I have seen Reverend Mariama in multiple actions protesting the West Roxbury Lateral Pipeline construction, which is just right down the street. Many of us have heard her speak passionately about climate justice at pipeline protest events, at an interfaith service which was held here, associated with the five-day People Over Pipelines walk, and at Moral Monday's Massachusetts actions. Lastly, we witnessed her commitment to stopping the West Roxbury pipeline this summer when she joined other climate justice clergy in a civil disobedience action, resulting in her being arrested on her birthday. Well, I was going to say, please give Reverend Mariama White a hearty welcome, which you already have, but we can do it again.
So, of course, I'm going to time myself to make sure that I stay on track. Beautiful. Great. So I want to begin with some thank yous. First, of course, to Theodore Parker himself for his amazing legacy, and then to the Theodore Parker Church for inviting me to be here this morning. I want to give a specific thank you to Francis, who's been sending me all the emails back and forth in preparation for this, and Allison, who I've known for years in different kinds of activism. And particularly to Reverend Ann, who has become a colleague and friend as we have worked in the trenches and literally in the trenches together over these last few months. I also want to say a larger thank you to my climate family. I know there's many people that I see who I've protested with and organized with, and it's great to see you all here. And I also want to say a special thank you to my Bethel family. There's a few folks who are here. Just wave your hand, Bethel folks. Yeah. And one of those people is my husband, who is Teron Dorsey. And I know... he does exist. We move in different worlds a lot, and so sometimes it's every once in a while where I get to go hang out with him in his world and he comes into mine. So I'm thankful to be here this afternoon. So when I accepted this invitation, my plan was to share my climate manifesto. I try to be a humble person, but I do have a bit of an ego, and I was hoping to give this brilliant speech that laid out the entire solution to climate change in 30 minutes. And I was really excited because in the Black church tradition, you can't get up and speak without doing exegesis, so I had this freedom to move. I love the biblical text, but I knew I had a freedom to move beyond the biblical text. And then I've been invited to a lot of predominantly white churches, but they only allow 10 to 15 minute sermons, and that is a real struggle for a Black preacher. So Reverend Ann told me that I could even have a whole half an hour, and I was overjoyed. But the last 2 weeks have been pretty intense for me. I am in front of you having performed my first funeral, unfortunately, of a young person, and having just returned less than 48 hours ago from Standing Rock. And so... My message is still of hope, but my prayer is always to be a vessel of the Spirit, and what is on my spirit right now is not a climate manifesto. So I'm hoping that what I have to give is what the Spirit wants for you to have. And at some other point, I really will give that lecture because I was very excited about it. So I want to be begin by telling a little bit of my own story and how it's led me to all of the ideas that were beneath that manifesto, that maybe the stories are more important than the plaudits themselves. My climate story begins in earnest in 2005. As Allison mentioned, I was running Project Hip Hop, and we were based in the Dudley Square neighborhood, and between two communities that were not always in good standing with each other, Whittier Street and Orchard. And so a lot of our work was trying to figure out how to bring young people together across some of the neighborhood tensions. And so we used to run a summer program every year, and we would go to the South to study the civil rights movement or go through the North to study the history of hip-hop and the Black Panthers and Young Lords. And the goal was for young people to have a sense of connection with the past and have come away with a sense of calling to activism that would shift the dynamics in our community. So I remember that I had made all that we had made. We had finished all of the interviews for our summer trip in 2005, and I got a call at the last minute from a caseworker at DYS, which is the Department of Youth Services, which is just a very nice word for our juvenile justice system. And they told me that they had this young person that was perfect, and I said, well, we're done today, so if you can get him here today, we'll talk to him, but otherwise, you know, there's always next year. And she mobilized and got him to our office. We met with him that afternoon, and his name was Kareem Burry, and he was maybe one of the most perfect fits for our program I can remember. He loved hip-hop, and one of the few people that knew that hip-hop started with the DJ, not the rapper. The rapper was like the last part of hip-hop. It was the DJ that really created hip-hop, and he talked about that. He was from the Caribbean and talked about the relationship between music in the Caribbean and the United States and the African rhythms. And I mean, his ability to expand on what we were doing was far ahead of most of his peers. And he had been out of jail something like 3 days by that point, and said that he knew that the skills that he had been using in some not positive ways were skills that he could turn around to really empower the community, and that's what he wanted to do. So we loved him. We're so excited, and I really knew. I mean, I remember like writing on the application that he was just going to be like a really strong leader. And so we took all of our young people on this retreat, which we did every year. And of course, they like never went to sleep when I told them to. And they like stay up and have these like really deep conversations or also put toothpaste in each other's hair and things like that. But he was part of that retreat, and it was like a really powerful, like the group really clicked. And that didn't always happen, but this group really, really clicked. And so that Sunday, I drove them all home and I told them that, you know, I would see them again on Wednesday, and I needed them to be on time because Wednesday was my birthday and I was going out to dinner with my husband. And so I expected to see them all on Wednesday and woke up Wednesday morning getting ready to go to work, and I got the call from a person that I knew who did trauma work in the city that Kareem had been stabbed that night and bled out at 2 o'clock in the morning in Nightingale Street in Dorchester. It was really challenging. Like many other Black young people, I had lost young friends before. By the time that Kareem died, I had lost a friend to drowning, to a shooting, to potentially a botched abortion, to undiagnosed diseases. I had lost friends, and it was hard, but this was the first time I was in a caretaker role where I had to figure out how to help all the rest of the young people who had just fallen in love with Kareem figure out how to process. And we had to decide whether or not we should still go on our trip and all of these different things. And in that moment, I mobilized, and I was, you know, the director, and I think, you know, I played my role pretty well. But I got to the end of the summer and realized that I had never had any space to grieve on my own, that it had been challenging because so many of our young people had already lost people in their lives, and so it had been triggering for them, and we had had to deal with all of those challenges. And so I got to the end of summer, and I told all the staff, we're going to just take a week off. There's no reason we need to, you know, have programming the last week in August. Young people are going back to school. Let's just take a week off. And so I was home. You know, of course you do those weeks off where you have all these plans about how you're going to clean this thing that's been sitting like in a corner for 7 years. And usually it doesn't happen until the next year when you're going to do that again. And so I had all these plans about how I was going to relax and spend some time at home. And I remember that that was the same time that we started to hear about this impending storm that was heading to New Orleans. One of my best friends had just moved from New Orleans and just evacuated. I think it was Hurricane Ivan was the one before. And we knew a lot of youth groups in New Orleans, so I was concerned because... you know, we did hip-hop and social justice. There were a lot of groups in New Orleans, or a few groups in New Orleans that also did arts and social justice. And so, like probably most of America, I just kept watching to see what would happen. And I was horrified. Not just by the natural disaster of Hurricane Katrina, but by the unnatural disasters caused by racism and classism and just a general disregard for human life. Before Hurricane Katrina, I had been a good recycler. I had been one of those young people in high school that convinced everyone else to stop using hairspray to protect the ozone layer. But up until that point, I felt that, you know, ending mass incarceration and working on educational equity, these were far more important issues than environmental issues, and I could leave that to the tree huggers because they would deal with that somehow. After Hurricane Katrina, I realized that the future disaster for our communities was climate. I thought about what drought would mean to communities that already have water insecurity, or what it meant to have tornadoes and hurricanes in places where people don't always have access to reliable cars. And so in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, I felt a kind of hopelessness and frustration that I didn't know what to do with. And so I said, okay, well, we've already taken off 1 week. We're going to postpone 2 more weeks. And I got on a plane and went to Gulfport, Mississippi to assist in the recovery efforts. There, I told them, whatever you need, I'll do it. And one of the key moments for me was when they asked me to help lead the women's Bible study. And I was like, oh, I can set up databases, but like, I don't know about the Bible study. For those of you who don't know, both of my parents are ministers. And on my list of things I was absolutely planning not to do with my life, being a minister was like top on that list. But while I was there, I found myself serving in a pastoral role, even though I didn't really mean to be doing that. So the summer of 2005 was a key summer for me. But I came back and I did my work and I got back into the swing of things. Until the summer of 2008, where I... From basically the beginning of the summer through May of the next year, over a 10-month period, 5 of my young people were shot. 2 of them died. It was a painful, painful time in my life. And the only thing, one of the only things that kept me going, in addition to my church family and my prayer practice, was my garden. I would get so excited to see an orchid open overnight. Like, I would run downstairs and like yell up to my husband, like, it opened overnight. And he'd have this look on his face like, yeah, and it did it 2 days ago. I don't know why you're acting so excited. It took me more than a year to recognize that there was so much death around me that the life of that orchid was sustaining me in ways I couldn't imagine. So after years of working at Project Hip Hop and years of doing work around trauma and unfortunately losing more young people and being at far more funerals than anybody should ever have to, I got to the point where I was like ready to be done, ready to take a break, ready to do something different. I had accepted my call to preaching, but I had been dragging my feet about doing anything serious about it, and my denomination does require that you go to divinity school, so the fact that I kept not doing that year after year was probably a little bit of me resisting my calling. And so finally, I said, okay, I'm gonna go to seminary, mostly because I have to. And I thought, you know, it would be a really great break. My husband and others kept telling me that I was called to a greater platform and this was going to be great. And I was like, yeah. But the real deal is that I just wanted a break from the nonprofit industrial complex. I was like, I'm not going to have to write any more grants. I'm not going to have to supervise any more people. I'm not going to have to hear anybody else's drama. I'm just going to be me writing papers and reading some books. And so the first year of seminary, that whole first semester, I was like, other people are like stressed out. I was like, this is so great. All you have is a paper due. It's not that serious. But my second semester, I decided to take this class. Okay, partially because it was intensive. So it was like 2 days in a row and it didn't take as much. It was 2 days in a row for like once a month. So I was like, I'm all about this kind of class schedule. And it was called Finding Resilience Amidst Resource Scarcity. Kind of a weird name. I have told her since then, like, maybe she could jazz it up a little bit more because it didn't exactly get at the heart of what the class actually taught about. As we really looked at climate and we looked at all of the facts I'd been reading in the paper, I came away from this class with three really interesting realizations that would guide my work and have been guiding my work to this point. I recognized, first and foremost, that there was a deep spiritual dimension to the climate crisis. First, I realized we needed to mourn this old way of living. That so many of us have grown up with this idea of the American dream, of having it better than our parents, and that so much of that was built on what we could have. The technology we were going to have that they didn't have, and the bigger house that we were going to have that they didn't have, and all of these greater opportunities, which usually led to more and more and more consumption. But that our sense of self-worth was so deeply tied to that dream that to imagine stepping out of it actually required us to go through our own mourning and grieving process. The second realization that I had, particularly as a person of color, is that I could not leave it to other people to find the solutions that would protect and save my community. In particular, I realized that when I looked at who was at the forefront of the climate movement, they were often the people that were not at the forefront of the racial justice movement, not at the forefront for economic justice. And that if those of us who believed in those things did not play a deeper role in shaping the climate movement, then we would only create new systems that brought in the same ways of allowing some people to benefit while others paid the costs. My final realization was, even though we are deeply entangled in this system, we have wisdom in our traditions, and particularly I looked at the Black tradition, that is essential to the kind of collective survival we will need moving forward. I actually wrote a lot about how there's a pretty popular phrase where we talk about knowing how to make a dollar out of 15 cents. This idea that we never had enough, but not having enough is what gave us the creativity to imagine whole new opportunities. I looked at how my grandmother was a consummate recycler to the point where we were like, Grandma, like, you're not going to need that extra bowl. It's going to be okay if you just like throw it out. But the truth is that these traditions were connected to a way of thinking that everything could be reused, that you might just find value in that thing. Now, of course, it also led to hoarding in some cases. So if you're a hoarder, I'm not promoting that way of being. But there was something fundamental about seeing the value in things that others threw away, that it was really important. And then I realized how much our tradition talked about trusting the spirit and the ancestors to guide us. This notion that there were folks on the other side working for, praying for our liberation. I grew up in this tradition where we use the phrase, the great cloud of witnesses. And I thought that was something that like everybody used until I went to BU and they called it for like a mentorship program. And I was like, you know, my tradition, that means that they're dead, you know. So it's like not necessarily the same exact thing. So I later realized it was a merging of Africans' concepts of spirituality and cosmos. But I thought that was a part of the larger tradition and found out that it wasn't exactly. And so I started to really ask, what is this idea that everything has value and can be reused creatively? And this idea that there is a spirit world that's rooting for us and that if we can tap into it, might allow us to do something greater. What are the efficacies of these two ideas? I didn't know how to put it all together. I just wrote a paper about it, and I made sure it got in time for the class. But I thought there was something deeper there. And then the Pope's encyclical came out. And it was like he said, like, way better than I could have ever, all of the things that I had been feeling in the time of that class. And after I read, I'll be honest, I didn't read the whole thing, but I did read most of it, the key parts, because he didn't say it concisely exactly, but he did say some great things. I asked that the Spirit guide me. I came on my next birthday and felt this real sense that something needed to shift, something needed to change. I didn't know all of what it was, but I felt like the Spirit was leading me in that direction. And so at the beginning of my second year, I just said, I'm going to put all my energy into climate and eco-justice. And my guiding question was, how do I make this vision in my spirit real for the people that I love? Part of that began when I got a call from a guy named Neil, who I knew because he knew me from like a youth work world, and he wanted to sit me down and talk about this youth initiative he was working on. And I said, okay, I love young people, but like I'm all on the climate thing now, right? So I can't join your youth committee, but you know, when you think of climate, think of me. Let me know what's going on. And he says to me, oh, well, while you're at it, there's this lady at my synagogue, Amy, and I think she has this other friend, and they're working on this big climate event. I'm going to put the two of you in touch. And so, little to my awareness at the time, that would actually put me in a meeting that dominated the majority of my year last year. Amy, BK, and Lisa were both members of congregations, one a Unitarian congregation and one a Jewish synagogue in Wellesley. They, too, had read the Pope's encyclical and been super inspired. And some other members of their congregation said, well, why don't we do an event to bring everyone together, like all of the different faith traditions, to talk about the encyclical? And they thought it was a great idea. So they got started on this event. And then people said, well, why are you limiting it only to Wellesley? Because people in Salem wanted to join, and Needham wanted to join, and Boston wanted to join. And so then they had to say, okay, well, we'll make it a much larger event. And so I went to meet with them, and they were telling me about this event. I was like, I'm excited. This sounds like what I'm looking for. And they said, well, and you know, we were thinking, if we're going to have an event, well, we might as well have some action steps for people. So then we started meeting with all these legislators to figure out what the action steps. Again, we were still just planning an event. But the event sort of became a campaign, and then we were saying, okay, so we'll choose these things because this energy bill is going to come out in December. We'll do this, and then we'll see what happens. So we kept, you know, advertising for this event, and before you knew it, we were like, we think we need a name beyond just the event. So the event was answering the call, and then somebody came up with the idea of MICA, the Mass Interfaith Coalition for Climate Action. I thought, we're choosing kind of a big name, you know, who knows where we're going, but you know, I was like, whatever, things need names, we'll be all good. By the time we got to the event in October, we literally, it was standing room only, and we actually had to turn people away to respect the fire code. And I remember being there, and I was asked to speak, and so I was speaking, and I did a call and response. Again, something that's totally normal in my community, but people were like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we did that. And I was like, what do you mean? We always do this. And it was that realization that people were hungry for deeper spirituality and connection between each other, and that the call and response was about being able to look at the person next to you and say something and not have to just look up at the stage or the pulpit, but to look at each other and to believe that some of the solution to this crisis that is killing us is in the person next to you. So in getting engaged with Micah, I began a journey to learn much more about energy policy than I ever thought I would. I mean, I can tell you about the advantages to 2-blade versus 3-blade wind turbines. If you're interested, I would love to talk afterwards because I learned a lot. I learned a lot about solar policy and why some of them have like a blue filter and some of them have a black filter and how that, you know, all these kinds of things. And particularly when I went to seminary, did not think would be at the center of my work. But the greater gift for me, as I was into my ordination process and trying to struggle, the greater gift for me that I began to awaken to is that what I was learning in Micah was not really just all about this information, but that we were beginning to develop relationships that were really powerful. And so when one of those people asked me to come to West Roxbury, I said, yeah, fine, well, if you're working on it, I'll show up. I've shared this, many of you know. I was hesitant to come to West Roxbury at first because I grew up in Roxbury, and my mentality was, well, if something was happening in Roxbury, West Roxbury wouldn't come out for us, so I'm not going there. And I have to be honest. But I went because a friend asked me. And before I knew it, I wasn't just kind of going to West Roxbury. I mean, I was literally in a trench in West Roxbury. And I learned more about FERC and fossil fuel transmission lines and fracking than I ever knew before. But what was more valuable were the relationships that I built with folks who were finding their voice to push back on a really behemoth system that told us there was no way we could win. And so many of us keep waking up every day kind of hoping we're not going to get the email that Spectra has turned on that pipeline. But the reality is, I've been thinking about it ever since November 1st, every day. And yet, even if they turn that pipeline on, I am crystal clear that they have awakened a sleeping giant. That the relationships that were formed in the battle in that trench are relationships that will ultimately help us win the war against climate. So I've seen Micah come to a deeper place of wanting to build bridges into communities. I've seen the pipeline bring in new people that hadn't been engaged in this before. And on the morning of October 20th, I planned to head to the pipeline with a black minister that I had recruited. I was trying to get more and more folks out here. And I got a call. I got a call that one of my young people who I had kept in touch with after Project Hip Hop, who's become like a younger brother to me, I'm the godmother to his child, John Peterson Caesar, had been shot in the head on Nasing Street and was in the hospital at BMC. The challenge for me was that John is one of those folks that I always think about when I think about green jobs. When I talk about our communities being able to build our own turbines or wanting to look up and see solar panels going up on the roof with a young person that I knew, he was the young person I always thought of. He's the one I think about when I'm out marching for Fight for 15, because I feel like if John and Ebony were getting decent wages, they wouldn't have to struggle so much to raise their daughter. And so I went to the hospital again, like I'd done so many times before, feeling frustrated and doing all the healing work I tried to do. And that week later, after he had been shot, on that Friday, I went with his family to see his body for the last time before the funeral. I left the parking lot of the funeral home, and we were headed to visit a friend. Earlier that day, I'd been working on the eulogy, and I'd got a call from someone saying, "Hey, are you going to Standing Rock?" They sent out a call to clergy to go to Standing Rock. And I was just like, I don't have the money, and I don't have the energy to think about this. The truth is, I was in a state of sadness. But after we left the funeral home, I picked up my husband. We were going to visit with some friends, and I get a call, and I end up on this call of all Episcopalians and me talking about going to Standing Rock. And I was like, I don't have the capacity to think about this, and I don't have the money. And they were like, can you get this flight? And if you can, then we'll cover it. And I said yes. And so the next day, I woke up, and I performed my first funeral for a 24-year-old man who was so full of promise and who I always imagined being at the forefront of building the new world I want to live in. In that place of deep sadness, last Wednesday, I got on a plane and I flew to Standing Rock. And I asked my friends to pray for me because I wasn't sure how I was going to work through the sadness I was feeling and the intensity that people were talking about with what was going on at Standing Rock. But I got there, and I saw the camp, and something about it made me feel a level of hope. Not that everything was going to be all right or that it was going to be fixed overnight, but just the sense that people were resisting, that they were standing up and saying, no, we don't have to take this. And three things that I heard the elders saying was, first, the importance of telling the truth. I was so honored to be with clergy who repudiated the doctrine of discovery that was issued by the Pope so many years ago, saying, basically, if the land you're going to is not Christianized, you have the right to treat people like they're less than human. And that doctrine of discovery is what fueled so much of American expansionism and manifest destiny. And it is what caused so many Native peoples to be told that they could only live in these small communities in the leftover land that we didn't want. And so I was honored to be there with truth tellers. Second, I was honored to see people who have been so ignored, who have suffered through so many genocides, standing up and leading, and so many of the rest of us following their leadership. And finally, I was honored by the way they were reviving old traditions. Just as I was finding strength in the traditions of my grandmother that I had once thought were quaint and antiquated, they too were reviving traditions that are life-giving and sustaining. And so I was part of a march of more than 500 clergy onto the bridge where we could see all of the police officers and National Guard and a burned out truck blocking the bridge. I was part of sitting and listening in solidarity to the songs, ancient songs, sung by Native people, many of them in their army gear, because Indigenous people serve far beyond their percentage in the military and armed forces. And that was a powerful thing. And then in the afternoon, a couple of folks decided, well, we need to do more than that. We need to engage in civil disobedience. Now, I won't go through my concerns about the lack of planning of civil disobedience, because I was definitely a little concerned about our lack of planning. Like, we were going to confront the governor, and none of us even knew what he looked like. But we were driving, and finally we got some local folks to come with us. We drove to the state capitol, and I knew something was odd when this state police car kept going with us for like 25 miles. And I thought, I just don't think that you just happen to be going in the same direction as us the whole way. And then I thought, it might have been kind of obvious when you saw 30 cars with different license plates on their way to Bismarck, since there's only two roads in and out. So when we got there and I saw 7 police cars in front of the state capitol, I started to say to myself, I think they know we were coming. And we got in, and yes, they definitely had known we were coming and were ready with police officers in riot gear and told us we could not enter the building. Some folks decided to sit down and pray and sing, and some of us tried to keep the protest going. So they didn't just shut down that building. They actually also shut down the DMV and the state museum. So they were making everybody go out, and I had to use the bathroom, and they would not open any of the buildings for us even to go to the bathroom because they were on lockdown, as they told me. And so a group of us decided, well, let's just march to the governor's mansion, which is very close by and much less ostentatious than I actually expected, to be honest with you. And we got there, those of us who had agreed that we weren't going to get arrested, of which I was one because my cousin got married yesterday and I was really committed to being back in time for his wedding. And as we were in front, folks were singing and praying and we had banners. And on the governor's lawn was about 12 police officers in formation with riot gear, plus a battalion like on one side and a battalion on the other side, and a bus big enough to arrest all of us. And we kept singing and praying. And then a few folks said, we're going to go across and pray on the governor's lawn. And I was like, okay, do you. Let's see what happens. And so they walked across and kneeled down to pray, and they were immediately surrounded by 8 troopers who began to arrest them. Those of us across the street tried to continue praying and singing, and then they came across and told us, well, this is an unlawful gathering. You need to disperse immediately. Before we had any time to really process that, they grabbed one young man and started arresting him. And it happened to be one of the only Native folks in the action. Not a clergy person, young Native young man who was with us. And everybody was frustrated and angry, and you could see us starting to be like, what are we going to do? And they said, well, if you just disperse, we'll let you go. So we started to sort of look at that. And then I turned to the officer and I said, but why did you arrest him? Why did you arrest him? I mean, we are willing to disperse, but why did you arrest this one guy? Well, I told you all to disperse. I said, but officer, you have to know it seems a little strange to us that there's like 50 or 60 white people here, and the one person that you chose to arrest was Native. Oh, well, I didn't think about that. I just, I usually, when I tell people to disperse, I just arrest one person, and usually, the rest of the people disperse. And in that moment, I didn't really think about this till afterwards, I was like, we cannot leave this young man behind. We can't. We can't allow this to stand. It was only afterwards I thought about how I just couldn't lose another one. I just couldn't lose. And so I said to him, I said, all we want is that you will release Eric. I said, we will move, we will go somewhere else, but we cannot leave him behind because we don't understand why he's the only one. And so the officer, by that point I said, please, people, no yelling, no chanting. Let's just have a moment, a human moment. So the officer crossed, and another officer came up and sort of said, well, are you all going to disperse? I said, all we're asking is that you let Eric go. We'll move.
He said, well, you know, and you get those guys that walked across. I said, those people that walked across and kneeled to pray, they knew the consequences. But he was with us. And if we are all free, then he should be free. And they talked, and you could see, and Eric said, you know, yelled out, don't let them take me, because they have been strip searching people and leaving them in prisons for multiple days, and you can get shipped to any prison in North Dakota, and it can take up to 2 to 3 days for folks to find you. So we did not want to leave him. And we just stood there and prayed, and I just asked people to pray. And after about 10 minutes, we saw someone come out with the cutters to take off his plastic handcuffs, and they released him and brought him back over to us. I didn't want to go to dinner that night because after all of that, people were like, oh my gosh, you know, and it was a little intense. I felt like people were treating me like I had done something special. But I think that moment for me is what is at the heart of the climate movement. We have to reestablish the belief that every life matters. That we're not willing to discard not a single person, not a single species. Nothing that is sacred will be allowed to be wiped away in the name of profits, in the name of efficiency, or any of those things that we've unfortunately come to value so much that we've justified treating people, treating the marginalized as though they don't matter. So for me, the hope in this moment is that people like Kareem, people like John, and so many others have already been living the brunt of a society in which some people are deemed expendable. And I firmly believe that only something as big as the potential of mass annihilation could awaken us to the hard work that we need to do to recover our humanity. But what's beautiful to me is that in those trenches in West Roxbury, and in the camp in Standing Rock, and in so much of the work I've been part of over the last year, I see us recovering a love for life that is the only thing that will save us. And so my invitation to you this afternoon is to heed the words of two groups of Black women that I think have some great wisdom for us. The first is Sweet Honey in the Rock, who remind us that we are the ones we've been waiting for. And the second is that group, Sister Sledge, that says, we are family. When we awaken to this, I know that we have the power to face and stand down this climate crisis. Thank you. Now we have a little space. I know it won't be too long so that we can get to the reception. But if folks have questions or comments on anything I said, or if you do want to talk about the advantage of two-blade versus three-blade wind turbines, I can also talk about that too.
When I think about climate One of the things that is the most upsetting is that a huge amount of damage has already been done, and that we can't really stop. So how do you suggest thinking about that or dealing with that?
Yeah, so I think that the reality of working on climate is like living on a very thin line between like depression and hope. And that's true. You know, you like get some email and you're like, oh my gosh, that's so much worse than I thought, right? But here's what I ultimately believe. I believe we are going to face challenging times, right? And I also believe that our ancestors faced pretty challenging times without many of the creature comforts that we have now. So I think that if we start taking responsibility for each other, two things will happen. One, we can minimize the suffering. Like there will be damage. We will face hard times. What will make it unjust is if some people are left to just die altogether while the other of us, you know, sort of scurry around, right? And I think there are real ways that we can face these things together and figure out how we may lose houses, we may lose stuff. How do we not lose each other? So that's the first thing, is that, yes, I do think there's going to be some destruction, but I think if we can make it mostly about stuff that we lose and not people and not species, that would be ideal. And that's going to be hard. We are destroying species daily. But the second piece is, I really think that there is a whole lot of innovation. And when I say innovation, I'm not talking about technology. I'm not talking about like somebody coming up with the best, you know, right, bad, like, and I love, like, I could talk a lot about solar storage and, like, why I'm so excited, and Elon Musk may not be the, like, nicest person in the world, but I'm really excited about some of the things that he's doing. So the innovation I think we can come up with is new ways of living around some of the sort of hardship that we're going to face. So it's not that I'm not saddened by what I see or what we're losing. It is more that I am excited by the way that coming together allows us to face that in some new ways. And I think awakening so one of the things that was beautiful while I was there, I got to participate in a water ceremony, right? Where I brought water from Massachusetts, we blended with people's water from Minnesota, and then we all drank together and walked to the river. As we reawaken our sense of love for the sacred in each other and in the world, I think we will fight harder to protect things. And, you know, there is no denying that there is some damage that is done. I just try not to let that lead every day, because otherwise, how would I find the strength to keep going? So I fight more for preserving what we can without being paralyzed by the recognition of the great damage we have already done. So, other questions or comments?
Thanks, that was a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
You said one thing early on, how excited you got when you saw the orchid blooming.
Yep.
And to me, that's an indicator, because nature is our connection, mm-hmm. and so much of what we've done with our technology has destroyed natural systems, yep. and ecosystems. And what I try to point out is that by repairing those things, we also repair the climate.
Yep.
In many, many ways. And that's what I'm sorry to say, the climate movement misses that message so often, and I'm really yearning for that to be added in.
Yeah, so for me, I think what you're naming is, like, I believe that nature is a manifestation of, like, the beauty of the creator, right? And so for me, and, like, one of the things I say in my church is, like, we don't have the right to destroy it, because the answers we may be looking for on a deeper spiritual level, the creativity that we may need could be in that thing that we're ignoring right now, right? There are amazing things that ants can do beyond just annoy you when they get into your house, right? That could be the solutions to our problems, one, and that two, are worthy of just stopping to marvel at in and of themselves. So I think that part of the work is actually to have a deeper connection to those things, to get people out. So I do like to spend time when I can out in nature. And not even just, I don't even always have to go all the way out. Just sometimes, have you ever just seen, I put on my Instagram, this tree that was like, somehow it was like orange and red and yellow and like slightly green all at the same time, on the same tree. Right? So I do think that there's an importance of like, it's a part of my sort of spiritual discipline to try to notice and observe these things on a regular basis, which means not looking at my smartphone all the time. And then also making it a habit of being in spaces, right? So I live near Carson Beach. And I try to make sure that I get there on a regular basis. So when they talk about sea level rise, I think about what I'm fighting for, not just like that I might die, but the idea that I can't imagine that my goddaughter would never know Carson Beach as a place to go because it could wash away, right? So I do think we have to make those connections, because if we don't, then we don't realize what we're fighting to save.
Hi, thank you so much for your wonderful words. One of the things that troubles me thinking about climate impacts in Boston is the huge shoreline that we have, Carson Beach, mm-hmm, and East Boston, I think of in particular. Yep. And East Boston is, you know, environmental justice community, yep, right there on the front lines in terms of the storms as well as sea level rise. And in some ways, I can understand the argument, well, let's build a sea barrier, yep, you know, between Long Island and whatever else is out there, I forget, Quincy, whatever. Let's you know, make a huge project,
yep,
to protect Boston and to keep people where they are. But a large part of me is thinking, wait, that's money that could be used to resettle everyone, to create new homes further back from the coast to retreat. Mm-hmm. And isn't this the wise choice to retreat in the face of, you know, undoubtedly we have,
right,
released the Kraken and that's all going to be flooded sooner or later. But how do we say to our allies who are, you know, living at the beach, living, yeah, in the flood zone, the things that you cherish, the wonderful places that you want your granddaughter to see, your goddaughter to see, we need to move back from and release our attachment to that.
Yeah.
And so I feel torn about,
yep,
it.
Yeah.
I want to be in solidarity with East Boston and other people, but I also want to say, no, it's not, yeah, the wise choice.
Well, the irony of East Boston is that most of the low-income folks in East Boston are being gentrified out anyway by people who are building these condos where you can bring your yacht right up to the condo. Like, literally, that's on the advertisement that you can park your boat, moor it right up against your condo on the water. So, to me, I'm like, do we not know that climate is happening? Why are we still building, large buildings in the water? So, I think we have not, like, in our planning, faced the reality of climate in any real way. I know that the city has just done this big effort, Imagine 2030, which is still soon enough that the climate impacts we should be planning for are still maybe a little further out than 2030. But yeah, so I think that the question around that is, again, this question of like facing it together, mourning it together, and then empowering folks to make decisions. So I do think if folks in East Boston see what's happening and we, it's,
I still would like to hope we're going to like get ourselves together by 2020 and do some seriously major things to change our sea level predictions. But I'm also realistic that given how well we've been doing over the last 20 years, that it might be slightly optimistic to hope we're going to have a sea change. Excuse my pun. So I think the big thing is to involve people in those decisions early on. So one of the things I've sort of recently been talking with some folks at MIT is to actually get maps that really clarify for people what their climate, the climate vulnerability of lots of different communities. Like create a scale so that you can look at a piece of land and say, this is its climate vulnerability. I think the second piece of that is that people also need to do some of their own vulnerability, right? What is your ability to withstand the way life will be at that place, right? There are some people, I mean, there have been always people who are willing to live in pretty rough terrains, but that's not everybody. And a lot of people bought into those areas with no, or are renters in those areas with no recognition at the time of what that community will look like in the future. But I think we actually need to start having some of those conversations now, because I think that sometimes we don't make the best decisions when we're motivated by fear. And we are early enough out that we can make the decisions from a better place versus being completely reactionary. And I think one of the big challenges that folks have, and I saw this in Katrina, like people, part of the reason people didn't want to leave is because they didn't trust that the systems that were supposed to be there for them on the other side were going to be there for them. And they weren't in many instances. So part of it is that we also, as a society and community, have to make a collective commitment that we don't say, too bad you lived in East Boston, now you get to go to the crappiest place and be totally disconnected from all the rest of the people that you know, and we'll feel like we did you a job because at least we didn't leave you in a place that was like totally vulnerable, right? So we have to think about all the vulnerabilities that people will have. If they move, they have to move to a place where they're going to have access to transportation to still have jobs. Because if you're not, if the subway is going to flood some days, but it still is going to get you to work, then you might not choose to live into another community where, yes, you won't flood, but you have no access to public transportation to work, which is its own kind of like vulnerability sentence. So I think the conversation has to be robust. And in some instances, I do think there are possibilities that there are places which will be abandoned, places that will have meant something very deep to people. And I think that as a clergy person and other people of faith, we will have to help people mourn that reality. And there can't be a get over it kind of attitude or treating it as if it's just like a scientific or, you know, logistical decision. People letting go of places that mean something really important to them is going to be a hard process that they can only do when a community of authentic love and support comes around them to help them move to a different place. We know that they can bounce back, since many of the indigenous groups that are in like North Dakota now wouldn't have been there. Their, you know, Trail of Tears took people to some of where they are. People can rebuild. It's not that we don't know that, but it certainly shouldn't be like it was with the Trail of Tears, where you know, there was no real help or support for people. And that is what I think is most worrisome. That kind of mentality or response to the problem is what will make people unwilling to have the conversation.
I'm going to take one more question, and we're going to continue our conversation.
And then I saw a sister in the back, because I know you had your hand up, but the two of you did. So if you want to do both, I think we could.
Thank you.
Well, we can hear two questions and try to answer them in one. But anyway.
My question is more personal. Mm-hmm. Hearing you speak, you give so much of yourself, and you sacrifice so much for others to help and to support others when they're in need. Where do you find your strength and refuge when you're not at that peak? What makes you say, I have to keep going? Because when you speak, there's situations where I would have said, I give up. I'm not going to do it. But you kept going.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you find that strength and refuge?
So I would say there's kind of three things. So the first thing is that I know that I come from a long line of people who didn't give up. Like, my very existence on the earth means that someone who could have died in the Middle Passage decided to keep going. And now they are saying that trauma is carried in your DNA. But I do think that there's some resilience in my DNA that comes from the ancestors that went before me. And I think of them as very present for me. I call out to my grandmother. I knew that John was with me and watching in that moment where we were trying to advocate for Eric. So I do, for me personally, I believe that there is a source of strength that I tap into that has really not that much to do with me. And I'll say, I think that if we're going to win, if we're going to even put up a valiant effort, I don't see how we get there just in our own strength. I think, for me, I say to people all the time, is I want to know where the Spirit is, because I believe, I don't believe that God has abandoned us. I believe that the Spirit is always moving, and I'm always trying to align with where she is. But if you might call it something else, maybe you think it's the power of what happens when people come together, or you have a different tradition. But for me, I just don't think science and good organizing just by itself is going to get there. I do believe we have to tap into something else. And I spend a lot of time in my spiritual life really trying to lower the barriers between my own sort of mentality and thinking and all of that, and the Spirit that I believe is flowing in the world. So that's one thing. And then I also have an amazing family and community. Like, I have a church family that will support me. They think I'm crazy half the time. I had all these Facebook posts like, if you need bail money, don't worry. And so, you know, I do. I'm trying to get more of them out there. They know that, because I'm always like trying to, you know. But I do think it's not just people on the other side that I know are sort of standing with me. It's also people on this side. And that's why I think we've got to build stronger communities. There's all this data that shows people have fewer sort of close friends than they had 30 years ago. We cannot win climate like that. We cannot. Because if you're going to go up against these systems, if I am going to go up against the police, I have to feel like somebody cares if I get locked up, right? And I know a lot of people care. And I know that they're not going to, like, leave me in there. They're going to be working really hard to get me out. My husband does not really do a lot of the climate stuff that I do, but is extremely supportive. Like, and we try to keep our home as a place of, like, rejuvenation. When I come home, I'm just really happy to see him. My goddaughter Soraya, I really wanted her to be here, but she like wouldn't have sat so well. You are doing an amazing job sitting through this. You're awesome. She is two, and she like would have been running around the front. But every time I see her, I just keep saying, like, I've got to give you the best world that I possibly can. So it's not that I don't get tired. There are definitely times. There are times where, like, I really don't want to see people, and I've got to, like, retreat in. I have once a month I go into complete silence. I take really seriously, like, Lent is an important time for me of, like, total rejuvenation. I go into silence every week. So I would say it's, you know, the sense of the history and the people who've gone before me, a really strong community, faith, and family network. And then I try not to skimp on my spiritual practices. You can't, because you will know when you skimped when you're up against something and you're cracking, you know, and you're like, whew, should have spent a little bit more time in prayer. Like, I, you know, should have, like, pulled back just a little bit and given myself some time to recover. So those are my strategies. Not all the time am I on top of them. Let's just keep it real. But I do try to pay really close attention, because I've seen a lot of people, this work takes them out. It takes them out in some really weird ways. I've seen people have heart attacks far too early.
And I've seen people lose the spark inside themselves and have to just go do something totally else. And I'm not judging them. What I'm saying is you cannot do this work without a deep source of sustenance, or else you'll burn out. So
Reverend Mariama, I want to appreciate that today was not one of your quiet days, that we had the gift of your wisdom and voice with us today. We hope you think of Theodore Parker as a sustaining environment for you if and when you need it. We're so grateful that you are with us today. We offer this Theodore Parker's own words on being a prophetic voice in the world, and we're so grateful to have had you with us.
Thank you.
Let's all gather in the parish hall for some more nourishment.